today is July 14th, 2011. I am at the home of Bobo, John Bobo Kelly and Karen Kelly, and we're here to conduct John's oral interview for the Gathering Project. So Bobo, I think we'll just get started by just letting you take some time to tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, some biographical data, where you were born, where you went to school, those types of things.
Okay, first I'll start off with how I got the nickname Bobo.
Okay.
It is a nickname. It's, my parents didn't give me that name. So when I was a freshman in high school, I was about 5'3", about 135 pounds. That was the start of football season, 1966. In 67, I was a sophomore. I was 5'10" and 200 pounds. I went through puberty in 1 year. I remember I had a paper out that year, and I bought a suit at JCPenney to go to the formal dance at Central, and I only wore it once because I outgrew it. The way I got that was the start of football. Of course, you go to 2 days and stuff, and you're in the showers, and I had a hairy chest and a hairy back, and all from the growth spurt. And a friend of mine who was on the football team had gone to Seattle that summer and visited the Seattle Zoo and saw Bobo the Ape. So he started calling me Bobo the Ape, and the other teammates picked up on it, and everybody else picked up on it. And at that time in Anaconda, there was, I think, 7 or 8 John Kellys.
Oh.
So a nickname wouldn't hurt, so I just figured I just took on the nickname of Bobo.
Okay.
And I've kept it ever since. I didn't really announce it that well or made it known when I was in the service, in the military or anything, but... And I had to recite, tell the, under oath, I had to give that same thing about how I got the nickname in Boulder in district court with Judge Frank Davis, because he wanted to know how I got the nickname, and he reminded me I was under oath, and I did tell the truth. I told that's exactly how I got the name.
Well, that's a very interesting story. And you were born and raised in Anaconda?
Born and raised in Anaconda. I was born... 1952, grew up at 523 Hickory Street, which is just a block west off of Main Street. It's mm-hmm. We grew up across the street from the Memorial Gym, and we lived in basically it's a Victorian style home, 2 stories. There was 6 of us in the family. There's my oldest sister, Sharon, then there's Kay. After Kay is Judy, then Mary Pat, or excuse me. After Kay is Skip, my brother Skip, Leo V. Skipper Kelly Jr. And then my sister Judy, sister Mary Pat, myself. There was a baby Mike who would have been about 4 years younger than me, but he was stillborn.
Okay.
At the St. Anne's Hospital in Anaconda, and then my brother Vince. And the thing about the 3 brothers in the family, my brother Skip, myself, and Vince, from the end of July, Skip's birthday was, I believe, July 29th, I believe, and Vince's birthday, which is September 25th, we were all 10 years apart.
Oh.
So, say Skip would be 50, I would be 40, and Vince would be 30.
Okay.
So, and growing up, people in town, a lot of people didn't know my age, didn't know that I had older brothers and sisters, as far as, like, say, Sharon or Kay or Judy, because they didn't live around here.
Okay.
And my brother Skip lived in Butte, but not around here.
Okay. Okay. Your parents' names?
Leo V. Skipper Kelly was my dad.
Okay.
And Helen Ruth Bailey Kelly was my mom.
Okay.
My dad was born in Anaconda, and you'd say 917 East 4th, where he grew up at. He's a Goose Towner.
Okay.
And he was the youngest of his family, and I believe there were seven in that.
Okay.
And his father, my grandfather, who I never met because my dad being the youngest and I was second to the youngest, both sets of grandparents were deceased by the time I was born.
Okay.
My grandfather, Kelly, Pat Kelly, he was from Limerick, or not from, from County Mayo in Ireland. And I thought that my parents, grandparents, my my paternal grandparents were married in Ireland. And that wasn't the case. They were. My grandfather had come over in the 1800s, 1890s, to work the mines in Butte, and then they were starting this, the smelter in Anaconda. So he came to Anaconda. He met my grandmother at the boarding house. She also was from County Mayo, but Bridget. Bridget Durkin, and I've seen two different spellings on it.
Okay.
D-U-R-K-I-N and D-U-R-K-A-N.
So okay.
I don't know if one was a typo or not. she had was following the love of her life, and they both did the Ireland to Boston to New York to Chicago, Minnesota, and finally out to Montana. And they didn't know each other in Ireland, but they met each other here in Anaconda.
Okay, okay.
That's what my dad tells.
Yeah, I've heard similar stories from my grandfather, only mm-hmm. From my dad about my grandfather. However, they were Swedish, not Irish. Do you know, through your dad, do you know anything about their lives in Ireland? Any stories you remember your dad might have passed along to you that he might have heard from his parents?
No, I he never did talk much about his parents or growing up. He did say that my uncle would have been Pat Kelly. He was killed in a car accident in like 1934-35. It was during the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And several teenagers from Anaconda were killed in that accident.
Oh.
They were, I'd say, teens or older teens or maybe in their early 20s. Someone had borrowed a car from a local physician that they worked for, and they took a ride up to the lake, the Georgetown Lake, and it was in February or so, and the car went off the road at Silver Lake.
Oh.
And there was six individuals killed, both male and female. It was kind of a real tragic area time for the town.
Oh my gosh.
You know, and
that's very, very interesting because my mother's first cousin was killed around the same time. We'll have to look this up at some point in time. It might have been a similar.
And my dad always said that his mother never really recovered from that.
Okay.
You know, and she died of a broken heart a few years later.
Okay, okay. And your mother's parents, were they from Anaconda as well?
Well, my mother's parents, ironically, my mother was born in Anaconda, but her parents weren't from Anaconda.
Oh.
Her parents actually came from, they were Baileys, and they came from, I don't know what part of Ireland they came from, but Mom never did tell me that. I don't know if she knew.
Uh-huh.
And they were married in Iowa. And he was a pressman for the newspaper.
Oh.
And he came here and he got a job on the Anaconda Standard. And then that's when my mom was born. She had an older sister and older brother and stuff. And then he got a job at the Independent Record in Helena, so they moved to Helena.
Oh,
and she
okay.
grew up in Helena.
Okay.
And my dad met her. My dad was several years older than my mom. and they met at the, I think it was the Marlowe Theater, where my mom was an usher.
Oh, in Helena?
In Helena.
Okay, yeah. Okay. And you have two children.
Yes.
And what are their names and ages?
Okay, my daughter is Elizabeth, and she's, she just turned 25.
Okay.
And my son Connor, who is 22.
Okay. And your wife's name is Karen?
Correct.
And is Karen of Irish heritage or?
No, she's Norwegian.
Okay.
She's a Ness from the High Line. That's the northern part of the state here. It's called the High Line. And I always say to them, our children are 100% Irish because her being of her descent, Norwegian, which is AKA Viking, which are the ones who used to come down and pillage and plunder the Irish coastline. And I always said that's why the Irish and the Norwegians are always intermingled, because where do you think Eric the Red came from?
Exactly.
He had to have an Irish mother.
I like that story. I like that story. And you mentioned in the pre-interview that you had been in the military. Do you want to just, we'll cover that briefly as far as, you know, like background, biographical information.
Yeah, I enlisted in the Air Force in October of 1972. Vietnam War was going on then, and the draft was on. A lot of people have forgotten about the draft. Now my kids don't even know what the draft is. And being typical Irish, I figured, well, first of all, I didn't really want to go and fight a war over in Vietnam. And I had to have the draft lottery, and I had the lottery number of 67.
Ooh.
And they were taking 130 or so at the time. So I basically went to school after high school, college, mm-hmm. to get out of the draft. And I had to pay for it myself, and my grades showed it. I didn't do well in school. So I said, the heck with it, they can't draft me, I'll enlist. So I enlisted in the Air Force. I was stationed, everybody goes to Lackland for basic. And I was stationed at Whiteman Air Force Base, Missouri. I was stationed there, went 3 months TDY to Guam. I got back from Guam, was there at Whiteman until September of 74. And I got orders for Italy, Aviano Air Base, Italy, and I was stationed at Aviano from 74 till 76,
okay.
And that would be in September. So while there, I went TDY to England a couple times, temporary duty to England.
Okay.
Because I figured I'd join the service to travel. What they wanted to do was to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And I did take a hop, they call it a hop, C-130 to Lake and Heath, England, and took the train down to the Big Smoke, is what the servicemen called London. And I flew to Ireland, and I was in Dublin for St. Patrick's Day 1976.
Okay.
And that was quite a deal there, because you had 200 of Boston's finest Boston policemen. They let off the parade. It was also my bicentennial parade, because every float there practically was in honor of America's bicentennial.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I got both St. Patrick's Day and the 4th of July parade, you might say, all rolled into one.
Wow.
And one thing I found that was interesting there, at that time, they had what was called the Holy Hour. You know, the pubs would open up usually probably at 10 or 11 in the morning. It was from 2 to 4, they would close. So that was called the Holy Hour.
Oh.
I guess they had a similar law in England, but they called it the Queen's Hour.
I see.
But I understand they don't do that anymore. They changed the law.
I see. And if you could, you mentioned that your mom was born in Anaconda, raised in Helena. Your dad was born and raised in Anaconda. What did he do for a living?
When he retired, he was president and general manager of the Butte Anaconda Pacific Railroad.
Okay.
It's a short line railroad, they call it, that ran from the mines in Butte to the smelter in Anaconda.
Okay.
he had started out there in the early 40s as a clerk. It was kind of an interesting story there. He had been working for the highway department in Helena, and that's after he graduated from Carroll College.
Mm-hmm.
Because he wanted to go on to law school, but figured he'd work for a while. He worked for a while, but he got married and started having kids. And he was up for promotion within the department. And lo and behold, his supervisor's brand new son-in-law, who never worked for the department, got the position.
Ah.
So my dad could see the writing on the wall, and he packed up the family and took a position as a clerk on the railway and worked his way up to be the president.
Okay.
And one of the ways he did that was, my dad had told me when he had skipped a grade. He was a second quarter freshman, and they moved him to second quarter sophomore at Anaconda High School. He said he'd never, if he had the choice to do that over again, he never would.
He wouldn't have skipped the grade, huh?
He wouldn't have skipped the grade. What he had did was, after he graduated, this I think would have been in 1933 from Anaconda High School, he basically stayed on at the school, went back to school, and took stenography and shorthand. So he could, typing and shorthand.
Mm-hmm.
So he learned how to take good notes, how to type and everything. And when he went to college, those came in handy.
Oh, yes.
But working as a clerk on the railroad, he got to work his way up because he could do a lot of different things as far as making sure the notes were very meticulous and
right.
Everything was correct. So, it helped him in his career.
Okay. And let's see. When you introduced yourself, you talked about your nickname and the fact that there were so many families in town named Kelly. Does your family have any other nicknames or naming traditions or unusual names?
Well, the nickname was Skipper for my dad. And it was also, my dad was Skipper, and the oldest son was Leo V. Skip Jr.
Okay.
And they called him Skip. So it was Skipper and Skip. And dad never really elaborated to me on how he got that nickname.
Okay.
I don't know if he could quite remember how he got it or not. I think people just called him Skippy or whatever. But,
okay.
It went to Skipper.
Okay.
And he also had a a band. He was a musician. He played, he said he learned the drums. He had to do the big bass drum in the Anaconda High School band. He was the smallest kid there, but he had to do the bass drum.
Okay.
He said that's what taught him how to keep rhythm, And he played music for many years. He played the drums. He had a band. It was called, one time there was one, Skipper Kelly and the Commodores.
Oh, okay.
Not the Commodores with the all-black group, but and he prided himself when he was in Helena because he had a band that had not one but two piano players.
Oh.
And there was a picture of him I saw by the Helena Civic Center in that park across the street.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the pine trees now that are well over 100, 150 feet were about 5 feet tall when they took the picture. And all his band members, it was about a 12-piece band. They were all in black tuxes, and he had a white tux.
I see. But other than that, any other, like say maybe your extended family, like Kelly cousins, any nicknames or common names come to mind?
Well, we got... That was just because of the 50s, John. So everybody's named John.
Exactly.
Or Mary.
Very common,
That was just the trend in those days.
Right. And we're just going to kind of maybe switch gears a little bit. Because you grew up in Anaconda, I'm sure that you have some childhood memories of Anaconda. What would, which ones stick out in your mind?
Ones that stick out of childhood memories would be, one thing would, Anaconda was home. It was the neighborhood. We had at that time, I grew up in the 50s in Anaconda, which is kind of the heyday, mm-hmm. you want to say. And they had, there's kids in every neighborhood, you know, lots of kids. I ran around with Marty and Mike Dunn, who were the twins from across the street, and mm-hmm. John Moe from across Hickory Street. And, you know, we used to, the old Anaconda tradition we called sleeping out. We would get our sleeping bags and either sleep on my porch or on the grass over at Dunn's house or the grass at Moe's house or whatever. And of course, when we did that, we always had to pack up and go and raid a crab apple tree or something, you know, just for something to do.
Right.
You know, and our parents were always, you know, like checking up on us and stuff too. So, something about the neighborhood too was my mom, those were the days of the working, there was no working mothers. There were very few, mm-hmm. Because my mom would always have the coffee clatch, either with, she'd have Mrs. Dunover and Mrs. McKernan and Mrs. Gates or all of them, or else they'd go to one house or another,
uh-huh.
you know, that sort of thing. And it was just, you know, you could go anywhere in town, you felt safe,
mm-hmm.
you know. It was fun just to, you know, to go downtown, and especially like around the 4th of July when Thompson's would be selling fireworks, and it'd be a nickel for a pack of fireworks.
Uh-huh. And
if you could round up all the bottles you could, because they would give you 2 cents for a regular bottle or 5 cents for a quart bottle, you know, so there wasn't too many missing bottles around town.
No. Kind of an advance, or, you know, early day recycling.
Yeah, and of course I went to, I was fortunate to go to parochial schools.
Mm-hmm.
Went to St. Paul's, which is about 2.5 blocks away. And like I said, I used to have to, we'd cut across, Denny Leary picked me up and stuff, and we'd cut across through my place, over through McKernan's, down through Nichols's, over to St. Paul's. I remember Mrs. McKernan, she knew everybody's grades before their parents knew, because when you came back through when it was report card day, she knew, and she would demand to see your report card.
Oh,
and she would talk to you about your report card.
On your way through the yard?
On your way through the yard, yeah.
That's a good one. That's
so
a good
she
one.
Just, you know, she made sure that she knew what was going on with all the neighborhood kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And St. Paul's was a great school to be at. It was started out there first grade. I was scared. I actually had to be drugged to school physically by my older sister Judy and her friend Cheryl Fortner, because my sister Mary Pat, who's a year older than me, had me so scared of school and the nuns. I was so scared to death of the nuns. And I learned one very important lesson one day when I came home. My mom asked me how school was, and I said, well, it wasn't very good because sister so-and-so slapped me. Well, that's the last time I said that, because my mom grabbed a hold of me and she slapped me across the top of the head and says, well, if the good nun slapped me again, had to hit you, slap, you must have deserved it. Yeah. So after that, I don't care if the nun put me on the rack and had the hot oil going on me, I would say, mom would say, how was school? Fine, great, no problem.
Did you have any favorite teachers at St. Paul's?
Never really. I wasn't that good of a student.
Oh.
I had glasses once I've been in the third grade.
Oh, okay.
And I remember in the third grade I was having one heck of a time. The nun finally sent a note home with me, I guess, that said, I haven't checked his eyes checked.
Oh.
And then after that, it would be like, I never could keep a pair of glasses longer than a couple months without something breaking.
I see.
Matter of fact, Dr. Jacobson, the eye doctor that my family went to, he gave me a set of what I guess you call athletic glasses.
Oh.
They were just trying them out. He says, well, I know the kid who can try them out. I never did break them. Took one big chip out of the lens one time. Never did actually break them.
I see.
And at St. Paul's, too, we had a game that was called Last One Up. And that would be where you'd run in the school lot to Maple Street. which is on the west border, to the alley, from Maple Street to the alley. And while there was no snow on the ground, you would just tag. And if there wasn't any, if there was snow on the ground, you could tackle.
Oh.
So, and the object was, you would start out with one kid being out on the grounds, and everybody'd yell, last one up, and they'd run to the, say, from Maple Street to the alley. Well, that individual would tackle one or two people, and they would also turn into tacklers.
Okay.
So pretty soon it was just, there's only one or two kids on, say, the alley side, running back toward Maple, and then when the last one was done, they'd yell, last one up, and everybody had to run, like, say, to Maple Street, and if you were the last one up, you had to be the one doing the tackling.
Okay. And, you know, it would be interesting, maybe a clarification for someone who might be listening to this, because I also went to St. Paul's School, and I would say that probably the reason that you had to tag during inclement weather was the fact that the playground was pretty much an asphalt lot.
Asphalt lot, yeah. It was an asphalt lot. We had some pretty good football and basketball teams in. It was an asphalt lot.
Right.
Of course, you didn't want to get too close to the edge of the building. As you know, if you went to St. Paul's there, the ice.
Oh, yeah, icicles, yes.
Icicles would form and fall and come crashing down. And I was always scared to death to have one go right through me.
Yeah. And then we had kind of briefly chatted about, you brought up one little tidbit that I hadn't thought about in a long time about St. Paul's School, and that was First Fridays.
Yeah, First Friday was tradition at St. Paul's that we would go two by two, you know, down to St. Paul's Church for First Friday Mass. And we'd leave the school area probably, I'm assuming, like around 10:30, because we'd go down. And it was all the whole school, so the 8th graders all the way down to the 1st graders would go two by two. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was the 1st graders went first, and then the 8th graders were the last ones in.
I think you're right. I think you're right.
The 8th graders got to sit in back.
Right.
And, of course, before that, on Thursday, you would be brought down two by two to go to confession.
Right.
And that was always interesting because it was always so spooky inside the confessional, and just waiting for the priest to open it up. And I think it was always, whatever you did, it was 3 Our Fathers, 3 Hail Marys.
One size fits all.
Yeah.
And you mentioned a little bit about the house you grew up in. Your family always lived in that, while you were growing up, always lived in the house on Hickory Street?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, they lived on when they first moved here, they lived in on East 5th Street.
Okay.
And my dad told me this, or mentioned there was a family dinner one time that they were renting at the time, and he wanted a light bulb put in the closet. Well, then the landlord said, well, I'll put the light bulb in the closet, we're going to raise your rent.
Oh.
So my dad said, the heck with that, and started looking for a house.
Okay.
And when they bought the house on Hickory, some of his old neighbors were kind of a little bit, I don't know if they were teasing him or he took it too serious, or whatever, but they said, oh, you're moving up to Snob Hill.
Oh.
You know, going from Goosetown up to Snob Hill.
I see.
You know, because there are a lot of big homes up in that area.
Right, right. And you mentioned the names of some of the families in the neighborhood, Dunns and Learys, and the fact that a lot of folks in the neighborhood had large families, so that there were always kids available in the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, there was kids all over the place. And they had the North Hickory kids, we called them. They were the Everts and stuff. And when I was in the 8th grade, the Gateses moved from Opportunity to Dwyer House. You know, Dwyer, so they had a bunch of kids too that grew up there. But they moved to Missoula when I was in the 7th grade.
Uh-huh. You know. Do you remember, like, say, as far as playing in your neighborhood with, you know, I hate to call them gangs of kids, but that's kind of what they were, the neighborhood kids. You know, what were the kind of the favorite pastimes?
Oh, favorite pastimes were wintertime building forts.
Oh,
snow
okay.
forts. I remember one time building the fort, and it was a warmish day, and we packed up the sides of the fort real good in my backyard, and we made snowballs, and we threw them at the basketball game that night.
Uh-huh.
And I remember it got cold, real cold, for several days after that, and I was up getting ready for school, and I saw Bobby Boscovich, who lived up the street, up Main Street, cutting across our backyard, and he saw the fort, and he was a few years older than me, and he saw him run and jump up. He was going to knock it down. Well, I said it got real cold with that slushy deal. It was like rock solid.
Oh.
He almost broke his ankles.
Oh.
I saw him hobble away.
Right. And you only lived a couple of blocks away from Kennedy Common. So I'm assuming that, did you take part in ice skating at the Common?
Oh, yeah. I was the world's worst ice skater.
Though. Oh.
I mean, my parents thought they were doing me a favor and got me hockey skates.
Oh.
They should have got me figure skates. But
I see.
It doesn't really matter. My ankles were too weak to.
Oh, whoa.
I never was very good. One of the interesting deal about the Commons was, at that time we had a tradition where the company would put up the Christmas tree. And from my bedroom, which I shared with my brother Skip, I could see the Christmas tree top.
Oh.
Some years I just barely see the star on top. Other years it looked like a whole big Christmas tree coming out of the junior high building.
Oh, yeah, depending so on how tall the Christmas tree was.
How tall the Christmas tree was. I could say it was a good year or a bad year.
That's a good one. And then right across the street was another common hangout for kids, especially on Saturday afternoon. Were you part of the group of kids who took part in the Saterday afternoon matinees at the Washoe?
Well, I always had to do the matinee. You know, I believe at that time my allowance was 35 cents.
Oh.
So I could get 2 bits to get in the show, and it was a dime for treats. Well, one was usually always got a sugar daddy,
because
that'll last the whole show, and you had a nickel to splurge on something else.
I see.
And it was always great. Every kid in town would be there, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Always remember coming out of the theater being blinded, because you're going from dark to light, and then, of course, you had to redo the whole movie you just saw in the neighborhood.
Of course.
You know, with your friends and stuff. I'll be Captain Cook and you be this. And, you know, it was just a good time to be a kid.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I would agree with you. You mentioned the fact that your dad played in a band. As far as, like, say, within your family, did you participate in music, you know, singing or playing or anything like that?
No, my sister Kay was in a little vocal group, I guess, in high school or something.
Okay.
Just like three gals or something, her and two other gals.
Mm-hmm.
Sang for amateur hours and stuff.
Oh, okay.
No, really nobody else in our family was very musical.
Oh.
My dad was. We'd have the stereo, the old
stack
of wax, and he put his 33 and a third LPs up there, and Guy Lombardo and the Royal Canadians and the big band era. That kind
I
of
see.
Stuff. You know, that's what we would have to listen to. Like Sundays was always the main meal day.
Mm-hmm.
So Sunday dinner was usually a roast of some sort, or chicken, or a whole chicken, or something. And Sundays was always Ed Sullivan Show.
Oh.
You know, you always had to watch the Ed Sullivan Show so you had to have dinner done before. You couldn't have the TV on while dinner was on. You had to wait until everything was done. And my dad had a demerit system, too, So if you got so many demerits, you would lose so much. You'd lose your allowance or what have you, get extra duty. We had our chores to do.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember being a little guy and standing on the chair washing dishes.
Right.
And put them in the rack for them to dry, you know. And when you have 8 people at home, or 7 people at home, there's a lot of dishes.
There are.
You know, and you got to do it by yourself.
Right.
You know, I remember I had to shovel the sidewalk, and I'd vow I'd never own a house on a corner. Well, the first house I bought here in Anaconda was 821 West 5th, and it was on a corner.
Uh-huh.
So it was right next to a school, like I was...
Exactly. So you had two sides of the street to...
Yeah, get out there and clean it up before they packed it in.
Right, right. Did your family have any particular, like, regular things that they always did for particular holidays, like 4th of July or Smelterman's Day or Christmas?
Well, Christmas was always, turkey. Mm-hmm. You know, we always had a turkey. And I remember helping my mom. She had the hand grinder.
Right.
And you'd have the stale bread and run that through and... the celery and the onions, and, to help make the dressing and the stuffing. And that actually was stuffing because they put it inside the bird.
Right.
Now they frown on it and everything.
Yeah.
That's the way I grew up, was that was the way it was done. And my mom, when my sister Mary Pat and I were younger, she used to make her own bread. Mm-hmm. And we would help her make bread, and we'd have our own little... tiny little bake pans. They were actual little baking loaf pans that we would get to fill ourselves.
Oh.
But we would help her with she had a big stainless steel mixing tub, and she would knead the bread and everything. And we'd help her fix the bread. And the loaves that were made, we put in the freezer, you know, because she'd make up probably, I'd say, I don't know, 20 loaves of bread.
Mm-hmm.
So we put those in the freezer and have them take out. And, you know, when they say the best things in store-bought bread was, my mom was happy when they did come out with sliced bread. You know, they got sliced bread because now she didn't have to make the bread anymore.
It was a lot of work. Yeah.
And, but it was a lot of fun, too. You know, mm-hmm. It was, like I say, we took pride in getting our own little loaves of bread. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I'm the biggest one in my family, size-wise. I say I was been over 200 pounds most of my life.
Right.
I'm 5'11". Siblings, my brother's the same height, but he's a lot less. And Skip was just a little guy, you know, but he couldn't stop in for nothing. He'd go. we would just, somebody said, how'd you get so big? And I said, well, I started with the analogy of a chicken dinner. Because my dad would always get the platter first from my mom. And so he'd take his piece of chicken, usually a breast. Then we'd go to my sister Sharon, and she'd take a leg, and then the cage, she'd take a thigh. When it got around to me, I could get a wing. Pretty soon Sharon went off to college.
Uh-huh.
So I got a wing and a leg. And then Kay went off to college, so I got a wing, a leg, and a thigh. Well, pretty soon I had the whole damn chicken.
I see. That's a good story. And I know that you are a member of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, as far as, like, say, a designated, recognized Irish-American group in Anaconda. I'm assuming your dad was a member, was he?
Yeah.
Was he the one who influenced you to join the AOH?
Oh, yeah, part of it. He joined, I think it was in 61.
Okay.
You know, which was a little later on, but I think it was, he had most of the kids by then, because, well, yeah, he did, because Vince was born that year.
Okay.
He was always, St. Patrick's Day in our house was always kind of a mixed bag, because my mother lived for the day.
Oh.
She loved the at that time they were called the auxiliary.
Okay, so your mom was a member of the ladies' auxiliary.
She was a member, and she was past president of the auxiliary. My dad was past president of the AOH. But St. Patrick's Day, my dad very rarely took the day off from work,
mm-hmm.
unless I don't think he ever did. And my mom, like I said, lived for the day.
Okay.
And they would do the breakfast, and this is at the old AOH hall, and they had the infamous, you probably heard about this, the McNamara's Band.
Yes, yes.
Which the Ladies Auxiliary performed, and they made kind of a, what I call hula skirts with the green cray paper.
Yes.
And these had white slacks underneath that and a blouse, and they had the little toy instruments, the little tiny toy instruments that, you know, kind of like, sound like a gazoo or whatever you call it, the kazoo.
Oh, kazoos
kind of,
and yeah,
like, but they're just the small, tiny ones.
Right.
And, but they would play McNamara's band. Well, they did that for the breakfast, and they cleaned up after breakfast, and somebody says, well, let's go up here to so-and-so's bar, and we'll perform for them.
Oh.
Well, it was kind of a wet, rainy St. Patrick's Day, but they trooped on up the street, and went up through the Park Cafe and down to Skinny's and all the pubs in between, and playing their musical instruments, and of course, being wet, the crepe paper stained all of their slacks.
Right.
There was a few disgruntled husbands.
I see.
The ladies had a grand time, and one of the ladies' traditions too, when I was growing up, was later on, they would go up to the embassy. Jimmy Edwards is up at the embassy, and they would do kind of a samba dance to YMCA.
Oh.
Kind of ironic, a homosexual group singing about YMCA, but the ladies loved the song and they would have their own deal. It was always kind of tradition to go up there and watch the ladies perform YMCA.
I see. Yeah, kind of breaking out of that, the standard Irish pub songs
for the
day, right?
And my mother, she, and my dad were both Americanized Irish, I guess you want to put it that way.
Right.
They loved, like, when, you know, loved Danny Boy, of course, and,
mm-hmm.
and When Irish Eyes Are Smiling. And that.
Oh, okay.
But if you put something on by the Chieftains or something more traditional, what's that?
Right.
That's not good.
More the Bing Crosby type Irish.
Yeah, more the
Irish Bing,
the crooners. The crooners
okay.
instead of the deals. And I, myself, I like the Rebel songs.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And, of course, I was known in high school when we have get-togethers, ice cream socials, and I would sing Black Velvet Band. You know, of course, then the Bohunk girls would always sing Oga Mishka Pegla. So.
And, you know, and that is an interesting aspect of growing up in Anaconda, that that there were so many other very distinct ethnic groups in town, like the Croatian community and
the Italian community.
Yeah.
I didn't realize. I always wondered why there was a Serbian church and a Serbian hall, and it wasn't until the troubles in the Balkans that I found out why.
Exactly.
You know, I never knew that. I didn't know if find out later on down the road the Italian factions. There was the Cantaloupe faction and the Northern Italy faction.
Right.
You know, they didn't like each other all that well.
That's right.
You know,
but it is that the little enclaves are very interesting, yeah, in Anaconda.
Well, like in Anaconda and the railroad, if you want a job on the rip track, you had to speak Italian.
Ah.
Because all the guys on the rip track were Italian.
Aha.
My dad always told the story jokingly. Said he had a worker who had been in Anaconda for over 2 years, and he came to work on the railroad and handing out cigars. Hey, Bambino. Hey, Luigi, what's this? You got a boy? Yeah. He says, Bambino, molto bene, Bambino. Luigi, you're here 2 years. He says, how can you? You never went back. You went back to Italy, so how can you be celebrating the birth of your son? Ah, don't worry. My cousin, he take care of everything.
Yeah, that is interesting. How do you think Anaconda has changed over the years, say from the time you were growing, a grade school, high school, kind of now, you know, the kind of the Anaconda that you knew versus the Anaconda that your kids grew up in?
Well, my kids never knew what the smelter was.
Right.
Did not know what the smelter was. Didn't know what the railroad was, basically. You know, the Butte Anaconda Pacific. You know, my dad was very proud of the railroad. You know, mm-hmm. And while it was a short line railroad, he said it hauled the most tonnage of any type of railroad around. So they didn't have that. They didn't have the company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was always the company, you know. The company will do this or the company will do that. They were either heroes or villains,
mm-hmm.
because that's how people saw them. You know, one side they went, oh, these are great. This company does a great job with this, but no good SOBs for that.
Right, right.
You know, it's always the company.
Right.
And, you know, growing up here, you have a wind inversion, or the wind would come in from the east and you'd really get socked in with the sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
know, depending on the weather-wise and stuff. You know, and you always knew you were from Anaconda then because you could taste like you just got through licking a book of matches.
I remember those. I remember that scent, that taste. Yeah, exactly.
I never did think of anything of like being toxic or anything like that. I mean, I worked upon the smelter, I worked on the railroad. Mm-hmm. And we just worked. And I mean, I guess I survived. And, you know, I'm 59, so I'll be 60 next year, which is still young.
Right.
But I'm just saying, it seems like the... Anymore, the government thinks we should have a foot growing out of the top of our head. We should be some sort of mutants growing up around this waste disposal site.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that waste disposal site earned a lot of degrees.
It did. Did you work summer while you were going to college? Did you work summers for on the smelter or on the railroad? Or?
Yeah, I started on the railroad my senior year in high school.
Okay.
Around Christmas break. And I forget, Mrs. Corrigan, she was a nurse up at the hospital, and I brought in my slip to get some blood drawn for the physical. And she wasn't going to do it because I was going to school with her daughter at the time. We were both seniors at Central.
Oh.
And she said, well, I'm not going to allow this. I says, well, no, I'm just going to get a job on the railroad. So, well, I'm not going to do it. You're going to finish your high school education. Oh, I'm still going to finish it. Yeah. I'm just working weekends.
Oh.
She thought I was going to work full-time on the railroad.
Oh, I see. I see.
I said, no. I was able to work on the week of that Christmas break and on the weekends.
Right.
And I was able to work while I was going to school at Eastern after high school, Eastern Montana College. I'd come home for a Christmas break or spring break, and I wouldn't go on a break. I'd go to work.
Right.
Which was a break for me. You know, and when I went to school in Bozeman, same deal there until 1980 when the operations were halted. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't able to do it then.
Right, right.
And I'd have guys on the section crew say, well, good guy, Kelly, you're supposed to be on break. Why don't you take a vacation? I said, this is a vacation. You know, and besides that, when you're going to college and looking through the upper dresser drawer to see if you dropped any change.
Right.
Because you're looking for any type of money to have.
That's true.
You know, so it paid good money, and it was hard work, but it was good money.
Right, right. And after you completed your degree at MSU, then what kind of employment did you...
I graduated degree in film and television and photography option. And I always wanted to have my own studio. So mm-hmm. I came back here and started Kelly Studio, which hindsight, but I was just stubborn Irish. I said, oh, I'll do it. This is my goal. I'm going to mm-hmm. I'm gonna finish my goal. Well, the economy being such as it was, and I had a competition, was a high school teacher here who had his insurance and everything paid for.
Right, right.
So I had to charge more, and I couldn't get to work. Yeah, long story short, ended up having to close it down, the shop, and went to work for the state of Montana at the Department of Corrections at the prison as a prison guard, mm-hmm. Correctional officer. And that was kind of a downer moment for me. I said, here I go, get my degree and stuff and do all this, and I still end up being a correctional officer. But I said, well, at least I can put food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I retired from the Department of Corrections, retired as a probation and parole officer. I'd probably still be working there too, but I hit the wall. I mean, there's so much you see and so much you experience and stuff, and it's hard on the psyche.
It is, yeah.
You know, and I just needed to get away from there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I'm trying to think if there were any of these wonderful questions that I had ticked off during the pre-interview. Okay, we've talked about community. Sayings. Any sayings common to your family?
No, I don't think any sayings.
Okay.
I know a good friend of the family is Bill Lester. If he called you a horse's ass, meant you were in good terms with him.
Okay. Kind of those backhanded Irish compliments, right?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Right?
And he said, he said one thing one time. I remember someone was arguing with Bill, and he goes, "Now, wait a minute, don't get your shit hot."
Yeah, you know, sometimes these, okay, and we did talk about traditional, well, not so much traditional holiday foods, but you mentioned your mom and the bread baking. Were there any other foods maybe that you might associate with Irish culture that, you know, are part of your family's?
My mom always made Irish stew for picnics and stuff. But it wasn't the Irish stew that you're supposed to have, like lamb. It was always with brown steak.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did we talk about this when we did the pre-interview? Did your mom do pasties as well?
Oh, my aunt.
Or your aunt did pasties, okay.
Yeah, my Aunt Mabel, which is my dad's sister. She gave a recipe my sister Sharon got the recipe from her son John after she had passed. And because Sharon always wanted the recipe, because Aunt Mabel did, I think, make real good pasties.
Right.
And had the carrot and onion and everything in there. But the main thing was, you start out with, was first you get $1.25 worth of round steak.
That would be very interesting.
I guess you had to convert that to like the 1958 or something, price-wise, to see how much that $1.25 would buy.
Right. So it wasn't in pounds and ounces. It was
$1.25. $1.25 worth.
I see.
Which right now would be, you could make Where's the Beef Stew?
Exactly. Did your family keep or hang on to or pass down any particular like mementos or photo albums or those types of things?
We've got some photo albums we picked up from the house before we sold it.
Okay.
They're kept down in the basement, you know. And a lot of times I don't even know who they are, you know.
That seems to be a very common comment when I ask people about photographs. You know,
my mom
who's
always
in the
told
photograph?
Me she was going to get a deal for each one of those kids, because you can't tell if it's me or Skip or Vince as the boy, unless, well, Vince was using colored picture by then. We're all black and white, Skip and I. And she was always going to put little photo albums together for us. Well,
right.
That never got done. So.
Right.
Which,
right.
I mean, Mom had enough to do anyway.
Exactly. And because you grew up in one house in that same neighborhood, and you said that, you know, when you were cleaning the house, was that difficult to do, to see the house you grew up in, have to, you know, leave the family?
Yeah, it was. A lot of memories in that house. You
mm-hmm.
know, good and bad.
Right,
you know,
right.
And just the different things, the wind rustling through the front door open, because we had two doorways to go upstairs, and in the summertime we tried to keep them both open, so the wind would go upstairs.
Right.
You get pretty damn warm. That's why you'd sleep out on the porch a lot.
Right.
Because you get too hot upstairs.
Right.
Or just the aroma of, like, my mom's turkey dinners or dinners or what have you. And, of course, being Victorian, the smallest room in the house was the kitchen.
Right.
So we used to have to move so Mom could open up the oven door to get the food out, and then move everything back again.
Right. Well, those are good little tidbits. And you had mentioned that when you were in the service, you made a trip to Ireland. Have you been back to Ireland?
Yeah.
Yeah,
a couple of years ago, Karen and I were there. We went to the mainland first, and Italy, Germany, Austria, Switzerland, France. We took a ferry from France to Ireland,
mm-hmm.
and then rented a car from there. Karen had to have dental work done because she was gritting her teeth so hard because over there you drive on the wrong side of the road. And I was bound and determined not to get the rearview mirror clipped off, which happens to a lot of Yanks
right. Apparently
over there. And so I would drive close to the edge of the road, and Karen would say, "Dear, it may look like it's just bushes here, but there's a damn stone fence behind there."
I can sympathize with her. I've had to ride on that side of the car in Ireland. Like, yes.
But she didn't want to drive, and I had the international driver's license. So. But one thing about Ireland, the two times I was there, first time there, I remember leaving Dunleary, Ireland, to go to Holyhead, Wales, taking the ferry back to England. I flew in and took a boat back.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, well, my ancestors were going the other way toward America, as you could still see the shores of Ireland disappearing. And I says it was the best damn thing my ancestors did, because it seemed to me at that time, this is 1976, and the Troubles were still on and everything, mm-hmm. that it seemed like the get up and go had got up and left most of the Irish people I knew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had met there. You know, it was just it was kind of a sadness, kind of a malaise type thing. It just, you know, it's going to be the same no matter what we do, type thing. And then with the economic turnaround and the Celtic Tiger and everything, Ireland was booming the last time we were there.
Right.
Stayed with Teresa Cahill, a friend we met here, whose mother was actually born here in Anaconda.
Oh.
You know, and long story short, they ended up going back to Ireland.
I see.
Because her mother passed away giving her birth.
Oh.
So her dad took her and her crippled brother and went back to Ireland.
Oh. You
know. And we had met her several years earlier. She's a relative of Judy Kentak Ryan. And she invited us to stay. She says, "You must come to Ireland before I am too old to be of any fun."
Oh.
So I called Teresa the day we were about a day's out or the night out, and told her we'd be in the next day. And she says, "Well," this is in Galway, and she said, just go to the Salt Hill Hotel,
yeah,
and I'll come down and collect you. I said, "Okay, Teresa." You know. So when we pulled into Galway, though, my wife, due to the airline restrictions, couldn't take any fingernail clippers. So she needed fingernail clippers. So pulled into a drugstore, and while she's looking for that, the gal at the counter says, "Oh, can I help you?" And I said, "Well, yes, I'm looking for this street." I can't remember the name of the street right now, that Teresa lived on. And she looked at the address. "Oh, that's Teresa's house."
Uh-huh.
It turned out she was a neighbor from two doors down. So she explained to us how to get to Teresa's house. So we show up and we go in the back, and Teresa's sitting in the kitchen window there. And we knock on the window and she jumps, and here we are. We found the place.
Oh.
But Teresa treated us like royalty, great hostess. Had a fantastic time in Galway. And it was nice. I always, in my travels in Europe and stuff in the service, I always want to see what a house looked like. You know, when you travel and you, all you're staying in is either parks or hotels or motor hostels or whatever.
Right.
It'd always be nice to stay at a house.
Yes.
Just to see how all the locals live. And that was very interesting. It was really nice.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Well, I think that probably we've covered some great material, Bobo. Is there anything that we might have mentioned at the pre-interview that you might want to share with the if you can't think of anything there, I think we can probably wrap it up.
Well, I just think that you know, always proud to be an Irish. You know, always proud to be Irish. And one part growing up was Notre Dame football. It's not like it was now. I mean, there would be, you would get trying to think of the sportscaster, but it would be Notre Dame highlights on Sunday morning. And it would be, they were playing Michigan. They start out the first quarter, and this happened. Well, during the move of the action in the second quarter, and this happened. It was only like a 15-minute to a half-an-hour show.
Oh, okay. And,
but at least you got to see some Notre Dame football. I always remembered I always say the Jew wants to go to Jerusalem, needs to go to Jerusalem, or the Arab needs to go to Mecca, you know, the Muslim needs to go to Mecca. I mean, but for an Irish Catholic, he needs to go to South Bend. I finally got to South Bend, I think it was in 1995, 96, somewhere around there. I'm not quite sure on the date. But I was there the year earlier when Notre Dame played Purdue, but that was at Purdue.
Okay.
And my dad had the Hibernian special, which was a trip, and I had help him out on that, help him with all the stuff. So we took a bus up that day, I didn't go to the stadium, though. I just went to the campus.
Okay.
Yeah. And then when I finally got to the stadium next year, playing Air Force. And that's when Air Force beat him in overtime.
Oh.
And a friend of mine had put in the paper that Boston has the curse of the Bambino. And now Notre Dame has the curse of the Bobo.
Oh. So And I'm glad that you, because I remembered that we had talked about your being a Notre Dame fan. So I think maybe we'll wrap it up with this final question. If you were to write the history of the Irish in Montana, what would you want people to know about the Irish in Montana?
Well, the Irish are a very, very loyal group, you know. They'll stick by you. You know, you show them any bit of courtesy and respect, you get it back in droves. You know, and that they'll do anything for you. You know, and if you're wrong, you know, they don't have any gibes about telling you if they think you're wrong or not, because they'll let you know. You don't have to. For most Irish, you never had to ask them their opinion. You're going to get it anyway.
And I think probably you could say that in particular about the Irish community in Anaconda. It's been my experience.
Yeah. You know, and I say even if we've had some great Hibernian meetings where discussions have gotten rather heated, but at the end of the meeting, it's all forgotten and everything's taken care of, and you know, the vote has been cast or whatever. So.
Right.
That's the way it is. It is what it is.
It is. Well, thanks so much.
You betcha. Thank you.